questions?
I think most people who teach computer science have found that there's a broad range of innate ability.
Yep.
There's some people who stand up right away, and some people who like you can't count them into their head.
Uh-huh.
Do you have any thoughts dealing with the lower end of that scale?
Right, so the students that I'm teaching my media computation classes are the ones who are on the lower end of that scale in the teach scheme class. And those are now the students that are passing. We raised the pass rate from less than 50% to about 85%. So I think the context motivating helps a lot. Beyond that, I think that we need to think about new ways of teaching. I have gotten a chance to teach the data structures class this last spring for the first time in many years. And I was really eager to try out some of the things which have really come to the forefront over the last years in terms of teaching. For example, peer instruction, which is something that Beth Simon has been trying. Beth Simon's been teaching a single class, non-majors, of 600 students at a time. Three 200-person lectures in parallel, and she runs between them. And the peer instruction approach really works. And I tried peer instruction in my class, and I was amazed at the insight I was able to get into what the students didn't understand. Peer instruction is one of these techniques. There's a lot of great evidence that it really does work. And I would say less than 5% of all computer science classes in the country use it. So I think there's a lot of potential for trying to reach a greater diversity of students. But in general, the problem of, there's a famous paper in computer science education called The Camel Has Two Humps. Okay, there's the students at the far end and the students at the low end, how to deal with both. Well, that's some of what I'm trying to talk about here. Different kinds of contexts, different kinds of paces. It's a huge problem, I agree. Yes, sir?
I guess that the point of contextual education is not just to teach this context, but to teach the more fundamental, whatever it is. Did you have an experiment to see whether they actually learn it? For example, if you move those students to another subject, would they be under?
That's a great question. I do have a slide on that I should have put back in here. So two pieces of data on that. The one is the data from Beth Simon, that the CS majors have a higher pass rate and are more likely to remain CS majors into their sophomore year, and they've only changed the first course at San Diego. Okay, so all of the other courses are exactly the same, and the students are passing more and are still computer science majors in the sophomore year. So that's one piece of evidence. The other piece of evidence, I have a student, Allison Elliott. I don't have a student yet. She graduated a year ago. She's at the University of British Columbia. Allison Elliott, too, who for her PhD developed the first language-independent validated measure of CS1 knowledge. She has the same test that students score the same on as compared to their final exam or compared to an isomorphic test in Python, MATLAB, and Java. So with her test, we now can start asking those questions, and that's the research that she's now starting to do at the University of British Columbia. Can we start comparing? Because one of the problems is we're doing three different, very different languages between the different courses. It's also the case, so in her trial, what she found is the media computation students scored less than they did the students in the robotics course also using Python. They didn't score as well on her test. But we're also comparing students who have chosen to be CS majors compared to students who are in liberal arts, architecture, and management. So it's a challenge still to be able to compare these things. If we could go back in time and say, so did those liberal arts majors learn more when they were doing Scheme than they are due with Python and media computation? We didn't have the test then to be able to answer the question. I will suggest that when you flunk out half the students, the 50% you flunked out probably didn't learn all that much. Yeah?
You characterize science education to be more apprenticeship.
Apprenticeship.
No, apprenticeship. I mean, people are working all the time instead of studying theory.
Oh, you mean the high school teachers or the graphics designers?
No, even computer science in university, they study by
programs. By doing it, that's right, absolutely, yeah.
Do you mean big projects, or do you mean exercises, finger exercises? Because to say that mathematics and physics are not doing that is wrong. Nobody studies physics or mathematics without doing a lot of exercise. In fact, you cannot get it without doing a lot.
Oh, I think that's a great point. Alan Kay has made this argument in my blog. What are the two-finger exercises for computer science? Okay, for the most part, they don't exist. Most CS1 classes are organized around lecture and an every two-week large programming assignment. What are the two or three liners that students should be doing? Dozens of them. I recently got a chance to look at the Lisp book that John Anderson and his group produce out of Carnegie Mellon University, which is probably the textbook with the most CS research backing than any CS textbook in the world. And their very first assignment is, can you write a line of code that will take the first element out of this list? By the way, the name of the function you want is car. Right? It's like really, I'm sorry, that's not the first. First one is, can you add two numbers and the name of the function is add? Okay, these are like two-finger exercises. Yes, we need a lot more of those. I will guarantee, look at any CS1, you won't see people assigning those sorts of exercises. They, for the most part, don't exist. That's exactly what I think we need an awful lot more of. Yes, sir, Charles.
I was just going to comment that computer science is really the only one of these things where the apprentice model works well because of the quick turnaround. If you're an architecture student or a structural engineer, you can't just go out and build a bridge. But you can write a program in a day and see it work or not.
Yeah.
Computer science has a different, the apprenticeship works better because you don't have to take years. You don't have to even pick up a hammer. You can just try. You get an immediate answer.
Yeah, but you don't get useful feedback. All right? So if you look at Matt Jaden's data, all right, the most of the students who fail at CS1 assignments, their feedback is identifier not found. What the heck is that? I mean, you all see, anybody who's programmed in Java has seen identifier not found, which corresponds to about a half dozen different kinds of syntactical errors. Most likely you're missing a semicolon somewhere. Okay? That is, compiler errors are horrible. They are not useful feedback. And if that's where the majority of the class is stopping, it's not really working.
Yeah, but you have to, it sounds like you're trying to teach people a language without teaching them how to spell.
I think that it is exactly what we're doing. I think more of these two-finger kinds of exercises would be about learning how to spell. I have a blog post that gets referenced a good bit called The Phonics of Computing Education. We don't teach those, and we need to. Yes?
I'm puzzled by this cycling back to the problem of semicolon and identifier not found. 30 years ago, when I came here to Rutgers to teach, they were using Terax, which were these computers manufactured at Cornell, which prevented you from writing syntactically incorrect programs by the simple matter that the IDEs were such that when you clicked on a while, it put that while there with all the right syntax, so we weren't hung up on putting things wrong, and which found immediately that when you typed in an identifier that hadn't been declared, that it's not declared, etc. So somehow that part to me feels like, well, I think we know what the answer to that is, let's factor it out. Now, the exercises that you're talking about, the finger exercises, that is a big problem. Somebody from Belgium showed me at his university, they have a list of 100 problems, and they tell the students during the first year course, at the end of the exam course, you're going to be given one of these things. Solve it. Okay? And so the students practice on those 100 problems to know how to solve it. But so somehow, I'd like the separation of the silly syntax things to which I think we know the answer, I mean, out there, right? It's been tried a long time ago. And truly deep, you know, what you're saying, in context, learning the notion of a list is much more interesting, and that's right, it's in the context of doing something that you want to do. I just want, it's just a remark, I don't
I completely agree. My first project with Elliot was on the GPC editor, which was a structured editor, just in the way that you're describing. And can you find a single structured editor in use today? Alice and Scratch follow the same sorts of things, but they are essentially, you can't make a syntactic error. Right. Okay, but the structured editor support code, they went away. Now, why did they go away? Because people thought they were inauthentic. Okay, that's not the way that software developers work. And so I buy that for the CS majors. But what about everybody else? Okay, part of the problem is, as Mike was pointing out, we don't have a lot of CS education research. For the most part, people in this room probably don't know about the structured editors, which were really prevalent 30 years ago. Okay. We need to Alan's always saying this, right, that nothing good has happened in computer science in the last 4 years, but you get to say that in a term. The problem is that there's an awful lot of lessons learned, but because we haven't done the research, we haven't reminded ourselves of what's gone on in the past, I think we have lost a lot of good ideas. A lot of these things that I'm describing, other than the new technology things that I'm pointing out, a lot of the problems, there are known solutions. I mean, like I'm pointing out, educational psychology knows lots of good things about teaching. We just don't use them, Right? So a lot of these things are about trying to fold these ideas into our field, and in some cases changing them so they work for our field.
So, hang on, there's a hand in the back that gets repeatedly ignored.
Hi, Monica.
Hi, I'm going to switch the discussion a little bit. I was wondering about the 8,000 high school teachers.
Yeah.
What are the incentives for somebody to become
one of those? Oh, man, that's a really hard one. I mean, what NSF is hoping is that they're producing the CS Principles class. Their hope is that will get blessed as an advanced placement exam. Schools do have a reason for teaching advanced placement. I mean, why is the NSF caring about advanced placement at all? Because it's the one way of making change in all 50 states plus Puerto Rico all at once. Okay, we have a highly distributed model of education, and the efforts are going on at each of the 51 battlegrounds to try to move more computer science into that state. But advanced placement is the one lever which crosses the whole country. So that's why AP. So the hope is, once you get the new AP, once there are schools want to offer that, they will want to hire teachers who know how to teach that. And if in the meantime, we can create other additional courses for those teachers to teach. So in Georgia, we now have a high school computer science curriculum. There are four courses defined. A high school can hire a teacher just to teach computer science, okay, full time. There's enough courses to be offered. That's where we want to get to. But we're in a sort of a chicken the egg problem. You sort of have to change everything all at once. The AP has to exist, schools have to offer it, and you have to have a lot of teachers to teach it. Well, we're in a big race condition. Yes, sir.
So, I wonder if you'd comment on this idea, which is what I got from your talk, which is there's really two audiences, and I think you're mixing, or it seems in your talk you're kind of mixing some of them. There's the traditional computer science people that respond well to the apprenticeship model. And you know about the people, probably everybody that moves here gone through that system. But there's this other space of people that I think also have to be sold, and probably even computer scientists have to be sold, that these people benefit from knowing some computer science, just like it's widely perceived that most people benefit from knowing some mathematics, which is why they teach algebra and trigonometry in high school and calculus. So I don't think that audience maybe knows that they can benefit from knowing some computer science to work in whatever context they're interested in. So for example, if I'm a media person, you know, I might not realize that if I can program the JavaScript in the Photoshop and know how to do that well, that's going to help me a lot. Mm-hmm. Or if I'm a biologist, and I've seen a lot of biologists, they struggle to program very simple statistical kind of things.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Mm-hmm. Okay. But as a biologist, right, if I know that, you know, if I know a little computer science, even a little MATLAB, that'll make my life so much easier.
Right. Okay?
So some simple looping and some very, you know,
yep,
simple things like that. And so I think that's really the audience I think you were addressing in your first talk, which isn't the same as the more traditional.
Yes, yes. I'm ignoring the more traditional. Though I will point out, as I did early on, that given the 30% withdrawal or failure rates from those CS1s, we aren't doing very well at that job.
Right, but I think internally, computer science is not a cognizant view that that is an audience that needs specific addressing.
Yep. It
has maybe different needs than the traditional computer science side.
Yes. Yes, so you got my point. That's exactly what I'm trying to say. The computer science, for the most part, is not paying attention to the majority of people who need computer science.
Yeah.
And the majority of people need a different kind of computer science pedagogy than what we've offered in the past.
Okay. And do you think, my other comment is, do you think those people also need to be sold on this idea?
Some of them.
I mean, we as computer scientists do a terrible job marketing this idea.
Some of them. I mean, you can see from the graphics designers, they're not eager to come into computer science classes. They are eager to use programming, and they're doing it very inefficiently and poorly. And so in some sense, it's our job. A different talk. Alan Perlis was the first one to argue in 1961 that computer science has a job of teaching everybody on campus to program. Very explicitly, 1961. Amazingly prescient. Okay, so the graphic designers, they need to be sold. Somebody who wants to be a high school computer science teacher, you don't have to sell them that they need to understand computer science and not just a little tiny bit of computer science. On the other hand, I mean, these teachers are taking these classes and bonding out of them because they just can't fit in the hours because they can't spend a half an hour finding a missing comma. Right? They need a different kind of pedagogy, and they are bought in, and we're not offering them things that help them win their goal.
A little bit of solid, I mean, to be put a little bit bluntly, that you're teaching scripting to people who, you know, have a use for scripting, like the web designers and media people. How do you, or when you teach algorithmic thinking? Because if you go back to the biologists, I know a lot of biologists who can write little Python scripts, and but then occasionally they try the obvious exponential running time algorithm and are kind of surprised if things don't work. So they do really naive things. They have a little tiny tool set,
sure.
And then they can combine it with more duct tape into absurd kind of ideas. So where do they learn the, at least that there is...
So I'm not offering you a curriculum. I'm offering a problem. Now, what they should be taught in biology, I think that's a fascinating question. So,
more generally, I mean, so the first class doesn't cover algorithms at all, the media competition?
It does touch on algorithms, yeah. But I'm not going to get into curriculum issues with you, okay? I will point out, we tried to offer a biology-oriented CS1. We started developing it. This was around 2007, which was a bad time to try to develop anything new because there was this stock market crash thing, and so all kinds of bad things happened and no budget appeared. And so we aren't going to ever offer a biology CS1 in the foreseeable future, so we stopped planning for it. But while we were planning for it, we met three or four biology faculty, three or four computer science faculty. We met several weeks over the fall semester and started planning out what would a biology-oriented CS1 look like. And it was great. There was all, they talked about the algorithms they need, what kinds of understanding of data structures, different kinds of representations. And then we got to the issue of languages. And a huge fight broke out among the biologists, okay? Because half the biologists said, well, I do genetics, bioinformatics, I need people to know regular expressions. We mostly work in Perl, but I think Python would be okay. And the other group said, no, I do large-scale simulations. These students have got to learn how to crunch data. I work with the CDC and grab all their data out of that they're gathering. I need my students to know MATLAB. And so we had this MATLAB versus Perl argument among the biologists, which was fascinating to me, that computing is so inherent in biology now that there are separate computing camps growing among the biologists. In the end, everybody settled on Python, because Python could be used with SciPy for doing large data, could be used to do regular expressions like in Perl, but then stock market died and finances collapsed and there's no money to ever offer that class. But it is really clear that biologists have been thinking about what sorts of computing is it that we want to teach. So it's huge issues that you're pointing out. What is it that all these different audiences need? What classes should we be offered? Absolutely. All I'm pointing out is exactly as you were saying, we computer scientists need to realize that the people who most need what we have to offer are not the ones in our classes now.
There's a whole lot of hands. Haim was up for a long time ago, maybe Haim.
I'm just curious, I'm kind of envious that the university requires a computing class. What do you think would happen to enrollments in the courses if that went away?
Oh, it would certainly plummet.
Differentially across them? Or have you
that's a great question. I don't know. Only about 10% of the students in the media computation class go on to take the media computation data structures class. So I get about 30 a semester from the 300 from the previous semester. There is a second engineering course now. The electrical engineers particularly wanted it. It was a great discussion. We decided to go to a 3-semester intro sequence rather than 2-sequence. ECE, Electrical Computer Engineering, wanted their students to take the exact same course as us, but they said, we can't afford an extra class. They said, we're going to teach our own second class. All right, well, what do you really want? And they finally broke down and said, we hate Java. We don't like objects. So we teach a course in C for that. Okay. Now again, that's a required course. This is the faculty saying this is what the students need. So I don't know. I have written a piece for CACM about how the requirement came to be. Even before the requirement came to be, our intro CS was over 1,000 students, because already electrical engineering and industrial systems engineering were requiring all of their students to take the CS1 along with our CS majors. When the option came up to change general education, because we were moving from quarters to semesters, the engineers said, finally, we want all of our engineers to learn computer science. And so that's how it came to happen. Interestingly, liberal arts was on board with it, because, all right, so we have a liberal arts college at Georgia Tech. How does a liberal arts college at a Georgia Institute of Technology distinguish itself? Well, one of the ways they do it, they say, our liberal arts majors know technology too. In fact, they all take a computer science course. They saw this as being a marketing goal. This was a way of differentiating their students, so they were in favor of it as well.
Question for you. You know, so let's see here. In terms of, you know, the AP course, you know, I'll switch back to the secondary level. You know, are there effective classes to go ahead and partner with? You know, let's say if you're a higher ed, engaging a K-12 school, you know, around computing principles. You know, are there more strategic classes, you know, to go ahead and partner with, to go ahead and, you know, get more bang for your buck? Another Trojan horse of sorts, you know, to go ahead and get, you know, these computing principles, you know, engaged into, you know, these students.
So you're asking what sort of courses should we be teaching, or should universities be teaching at the secondary level?
Or partnering with, you know, what are the good partnering classes?
Well, probably the two models which are being pushed nationally are the CS principles and then the Exploring Computer Science curriculum that's being tested in the Los Angeles Unified School District, and now being tested elsewhere. So, for example, I know Chicago Public Schools are running two high schools with Exploring Computer Science this semester. There's a lot of efforts to build these sorts of things. Look at ncwit.org. They do a good job of tracking these sorts of things. But Exploring Computer Science and csprinciples.org are the two that I can particularly recommend.
Cool. All right, last question.
So my question is about, well, first I had a comment. I think it's really important to talk about not what we're teaching, but how. I've been teaching an intro CS at Penn for many years, and my course has grown from 50 to 250. Partly through starting with visual computing with something like either Scratch or App Inventor. A lot of the faculty think it's babyish, but within a week or two, students are doing parallel programming, event-based programming. They're designing complex games and simulations without worrying about the syntax. But I also believe heavily in pair-assisted learning, pair programming. There's a really good paper on transactions of computing education about pair programming where you group people at similar levels. So it may be a pacing problem. Some people we think they have no ability, well, maybe they need a little more time to think about it and the chance to talk to somebody about it. And over time, by the end of the semester, they may be just as far as everybody else. So my question is about assessment. If we're teaching CS non-language specific and assessment, how do you see that going with pseudocodes, flow charts, word
problems? Right, so the way that Allison did it in her test, and first of all, let me just respond to your comment. What Jeans would describe is called pedagogical content knowledge. And in all other fields, math education, physics education, science education, reading education, there is the set of techniques you teach somebody if they're going to teach that. Right? You don't teach reading exactly the same way as you teach mathematics. You don't teach physics in exactly the same way as you teach chemistry. What is the pedagogical content knowledge for computer science? That has never been defined. It needs to be. To address your question, oh, I already forgot what it was.
Assessment,
thank you. Yeah. So how did Allison do it? Allison did it with pseudocode. And what she did is she developed a pseudocode based on, actually from back like 30 years ago, TRG Green. What do we know about creating good syntaxes that people can really understand? Because nobody had to write code. It was a multiple choice question. So how do you make the most readable kinds of languages? That's how she designed her pseudocode. And so she developed isomorphic tests. She built about four tests, all isomorphic. One in pseudocode, one in each of Python, MATLAB, and Java. What she found is the R-squared was like huge, highly significant between each of these tests. But then she also correlated the pseudocode test with the final exam score in each of their classes. So not only is the test comparable to the across languages, but the test is comparable to what the teacher thought was important in that class. Okay, she had 900 subjects, I think, in four different universities, which I believe is the largest study of CS1 knowledge ever. And so she's using a pseudocode approach.
So do you think that's what the new alternative AP test should look like? Like literacy, like vocab plus pseudocode, because there needs to be some problem solving.
It is a huge problem. What the heck's going to happen with the CS principles when they actually try to build a test around it? And I don't have a clue how they're going to do it.
But it sounds like you think that would be useful.
That's one possible way, or three different tests, one in each of Scratch, Allison, processing.
All right, let's thank Mark once again.